Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor and privilege to introduce the 40th governor of the great state of California. Please stand for Governor Gavin Newsom. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody. I'm grateful. Thank you. You may not be clapping at the end of this, so sit down. You never know. This could take a long time. There's a lot of betting over under. Someone said 2 hours or one. I said, I think one. We're going to be all right. But I want to thank all of you for the generosity of your spirit. I want to thank, Mr. Speaker, you in particular for being a champion, not only for all Californians, but being an extraordinary and courageous leader. And thank you very much for your generosity of welcoming myself and my wife into your house today. To Madam Pro Tem, I thank you for your commitment to, perhaps more than anything else, collaboration, which has just been demonstrable and I think has really helped make this first month together so remarkably productive. And it is a nice thing to say. For the first time ever, I get to say in this chamber, thank you, Madam Lieutenant Governor, for that introduction. Plus, it's kind of nice just to acknowledge the Lieutenant Governor, too. It's something that's not always the case. We got to remember our status. And to all the constitutional officers, I want to just thank you for being here today, all the legislators, and to all the elected officials that I see up there that traveled across the state to be here. I'm immeasurably grateful and humbled by your presence here today. And just so you're reassured, do not worry, Dutch is not here today. We clearly learned our lesson from the inaugural. I know. Yeah, you're going to be stuck having to pay attention to me this time, which I know is not so easy. Look, just over 4 weeks ago, I stood there in front of this Capitol, and I pledged to defend not just the California Constitution, but I pledged to defend the California dream. And today, I want to talk to you about how we can do that together. Look, by every traditional measure, you just heard that, the state of our state is strong. We have that record-breaking surplus. We've added over 3 million jobs since the depth of the recession. We're seeing wages rising. We're in a state with more scientists, more engineers, more Nobel laureates, with more venture capital, more patents emanating than any other part of this country. And we, of course, have the finest system of higher education anywhere in the world. Point of pride. But along with that prosperity and progress, there are problems that have been deferred too long and that threaten to put the California dream out of reach for too many. Look, we face hard decisions that are coming due. And the choices we make will shape our future and the future, quite literally, of millions for decades to come. And this is what I want to talk about today, as frankly and as directly as I can, the tough calls we must make together. And issues like rail, on water, on energy, how we protect our migrants, how we care for our seniors, how we help our homeless, and how, above all else, we tackle the affordability crisis that is coming to define life in this state. I won't pretend to have all the answers, but the only way to find them is to, I think, face these issues honestly. So let's start with some of the fear-mongering that's coming out of the White House about this quote-unquote so-called border emergency. For me, this is an echo from 15 years ago. And I was a new mayor sitting in the gallery at the State of the Union in Washington when President Bush said that the LGBT Americans could not be able to get married. It was an attack, from my perspective, on our friends, our neighbors, and on California values. I was so proud to watch brave Californians answer those attacks with love and courage. Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin made history when they got married 15 years ago to this very day. So now, just like back then, we must stand up for those that are maligned, marginalized, and scapegoated. Because last week, we heard another president stand up at the State of the Union and offer a vision of America fundamentally at odds with California values. He described a country where inequality didn't seem to be a problem, where climate change didn't exist, and where the greatest threat we face comes from families seeking asylum at the border. You know, just last night, down in El Paso, he said it all again. So let's just state the facts. We are currently experiencing the lowest number of border crossings since 1971. In California, like our nation, our undocumented population is at the lowest level in more than a decade. Some 550,000 fewer in our state alone. Immigrants both here legally and those without documentation commit crime at a lower rate than native-born citizens. And those families, those women and children seeking asylum at the borders are doing so legally. Those are the facts. This border emergency is nothing more than a manufactured crisis, and California will not be part of this political theater. Just yesterday, I sent a new directive to the National Guard, put them on a new mission, one that's going to focus on, respectfully, the real threats facing our state. I've now directed the National Guard, a third of the forces that are currently at the border, to be redeployed to help prepare for the upcoming fire season by joining CAL FIRE in prevention and suppression work. Work, by the way, ironically, that was curtailed during the recent shutdown. Another third will boost the National Guard statewide counter-drug task force by redeploying up north to go after all these illegal cannabis farms, many of which are run by the cartels that are devastating our pristine forests and increasingly themselves becoming fire hazards. And the remaining third of our Guard we've directed to focus on stopping criminals smuggling drugs and guns through existing border checkpoints. The wall that stretches thousands and thousands of miles through wilderness will do nothing to stop this threat. So the answer to the White House, with all due respect, no more division, no more xenophobia, no more nativism. We suffered enough of that in the 1990s with Proposition 187 and Proposition 227. Let's level about the high-speed rail. You know, I have nothing but respect for Governor Brown and Governor Schwarzenegger's vision. I share it. And there's no doubt that our state's economy and quality of life depend on improving transportation. But let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency. Right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from San Francisco to LA. I wish there were. However, we do have the capacity to complete a high-speed rail link between Merced and Bakersfield. Now, I know some critics are going to say, well, that's a train to nowhere. But I think that's wrong, and I think that's offensive. The people of the Central Valley endure the worst air pollution in America and have some of the longest commutes in this state. And they have suffered too many years of neglect from policymakers, respectfully, here in Sacramento. They deserve better. And the high-speed rail project can be part of that. Look, you can't say this enough. The high-speed rail is more than a train project. It's about economic transformation. It's about unlocking the enormous potential of the valley. You know, we can align our economic and workforce development strategies anchored by the high-speed rail and pair them with tools like opportunity zones that can form the backbone of a reinvigorated Central Valley economy. Merced, Fresno, Bakersfield, and communities in between are more dynamic than people realize. The valley, it's true. You know, the valley may be known around the world for agriculture, but there's another story ready to be told, a story of a region hungry for investment, a workforce eager for more training and good jobs, Californians that deserve a fair share of our state's prosperity. Look, we'll continue to support our regional projects north and south. We'll finish phase one of the environmental work. We'll connect the revitalized Central Valley to other parts of the state, and we will continue to push forward for more federal funding and private dollars. But let's get something done once and for all. And for those of you, I know you're out there, that just want to throw away this whole project, sort of give up on this whole endeavor, I just offer you this. Abandoning the high-speed rail entirely means we will have wasted billions and billions of dollars with nothing but broken promises, partially fulfilled commitments, and lawsuits to show for it. And with all due respect, I have no interest in sending back $3.5 billion of federal funding that was allocated to this project to President Donald Trump. That fundamentally would have to happen if we just walked away. But also, I'm not interested in making the same old mistakes. And that's why today I'm ordering some new transparency measures. We're going to hold contractors, we're going to hold consultants accountable to having to explain how tax dollars are spent, including change orders, cost overruns, and even travel expenses. And we're going to put it online so everybody can see it. New day. And we're also going to see some governance changes, starting with my pick for the next chair of the High Speed Rail Authority, Lenny Mendoza, my economic development director. Lenny, as you know, is running economic and workforce development, and I just fundamentally believe that transportation and economic development go hand in hand. So that's the position on High Speed Rail. Let's talk about water. We need a fresh approach when it comes to meeting California's massive water challenges. We have a big state, diverse water needs. Cities that need clean drinking water, farms that need irrigation to keep feeding the world, fragile ecosystems that must be protected. Our water supply is becoming less reliable because of climate change, and our population's growing because of a strong economy. That means a lot of demand on an unpredictable supply. There are no easy answers, but let me be as direct about where I stand as I can be. I do not support the water fix as currently configured, meaning I do not support the twin tunnels. We can, however, build on the important work that's already been done. And that's why I do support a single tunnel. The status quo is not an option. We need to protect our water supply from earthquakes, from rising sea levels, we need to preserve Delta fisheries, and we need to meet the needs of cities and farms. We have got to get past these old binaries, like farmers versus environmentalists, the North versus South. Our approach can't be either or. It has to be yes and, conveyance and efficiency, and recycling projects, like the ones we're seeing in Southern California's Met Water District, expanding floodplains in the Central Valley, and groundwater recharge like farmers are already doing in Fresno County. a portfolio approach to building water infrastructure and meeting long-term demand. And to help bring this balance, I'm appointing a new chair to the California Water Board, Joaquin Esquivel. And his first task our collective effort must be to cross the finish line on real agreements to save the Sacramento San Joaquin Bay Delta. We must get this done for the resilience of our mighty rivers, for the stability of our agricultural sector, and the millions and millions of people that depend on this water every day. Now let's talk honestly about clean drinking water. And this is not me taking a sip as a prop. But just this morning, more than a million Californians woke up without clean water to bathe in, let alone drink. Some schools have shut down drinking fountains due to contamination. Some poorer communities, like those I recently visited in Stanislaus County, are paying more for undrinkable water than Beverly Hills pays for pristine water. With respect, this is a moral disgrace, and it's a medical emergency. There are literally hundreds of water systems across this state contaminated by lead, contaminated by arsenic, and uranium. In solving this crisis, it will demand sustained funding, but more importantly than anything else, it's going to demand political will from each and every one of us. Now let's talk about our energy future and the PG&E bankruptcy. We're all frustrated and we're angry it's had to come to this. PG&E did not do enough to secure dangerous equipment or plan for the future. My administration will work to make sure PG&E upholds its obligations. I've convened a team of the nation's best bankruptcy attorneys and financial experts from across the energy sector. They will work with my strike team to develop a comprehensive strategy that we will present within 60 days. We will ensure continued access to safe, affordable power. We will seek justice for fire victims, fairness for employees, and protection for ratepayers. We will continue to invest in safety, and we will never waver on achieving the nation's most ambitious clean energy goals. But the problems we face are far greater than PG&E. Climate change is putting pressure on all of our utilities, public and private, north and south. Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric both recently had their credit ratings downgraded. This pressure comes at a time when the entire energy market is evolving, from rooftop solar, wind generation, to smart grid technologies, from community choice aggregators to direct access service, otherwise known as power purchasing agreements. More and more of our electricity now is being procured outside of the investor-owned utilities. Regulations and insurance practices that were created decades ago, they did not anticipate these changes. So we must map out a longer-term framework, not just for the utility's future, but for California's energy future, to ensure that the cost of climate change doesn't fall on those least able to afford it. I want to turn briefly to education. The teacher strike in LA is over, but the need to confront its underlying causes obviously has only just begun. Understaffed schools, overcrowded classrooms, pension pressures, the achievement gap, growth of charter schools, these stressors are showing up all over the state. Right here in Sacramento, in Fresno, in Oakland, districts across the state are challenged to balance budgets even in this strong economy. And at a time we're spending more on schools than we have ever before. You know, 7 years ago, we invested $47.3 billion in our schools. Next year, with your support, we'll invest over $80 billion. By the way, that includes $576 million for special education. It's important. But it's not enough. We're still 41st in the nation in per pupil funding. Something needs to change. It's long overdue that we have that honest conversation about how we fund our schools, not only at the state level, but the local level. At the same time, though, let's remember that the measure of a school system's excellence is more than the sum of its budgets. We need clear and achievable standards of transparency, more information sharing, and accountability for all public schools, traditional and charter schools. We also need a new president for the State Board of Education to work with our superintendent, Tony Thurmond. That can help lift up our students. And my pick for that position is nationally recognized expert Linda Darling Hammond. She's right up here today. Thank you, Linda, for doing this. There's another urgent moral issue we must confront. That's this homelessness epidemic. So many of California's homeless, whether they're families, veterans, victims of rent spikes, or survivors fleeing domestic violence, are invisible and left behind by our society. Too many on the streets are suffering from bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia, many of them self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions. And as a consequence, our homeless crisis is increasingly becoming a public health crisis. Last year, we had a hepatitis A outbreak in San Diego. Recently, there was an outbreak of syphilis up in Sonoma, typhus in Los Angeles. Typhus, a medieval disease in California in 2019. I know mayors, I know county supervisors, city councils, all around the state are working hard to reduce homelessness and its underlying causes. But we've got to have their backs. They cannot do it alone. All the mayors are standing up back there. So to help lead the discussion, you should keep standing up, Daryl. I'm appointing Daryl Steinberg to a new commission on homelessness and supportive housing. Thank you, Mayor Steinberg, for your willingness to step up and step into this debate and lead our efforts. With your support, we're going to put another $500 million into immediate funding for navigation centers, emergency shelters with supportive services on site. With your support, we'll put another $100 million into whole person care to replace the fragmented approach to services with ones that are more integrated and more comprehensive. And while cities and counties are on the front line, this challenge will only be solved on a regional basis. So we need to work together as a state and regions to focus on prevention, rapid rehousing, mental health, and more permanent supportive housing. Because at the end of the day, shelter solves sleep. Housing and supportive services solve homelessness. Let's talk about something we too often overlook. The Golden State is getting grayer. We need to get ready for this major demographic challenge headed our way. For the first time in our history, older Californians will outnumber young children. Over the next decade, our statewide senior population is projected to increase by 4 million. In 25 years, it's going to double, and more than half will require some form of long-term care. Growing old knows no boundaries. Aging doesn't care what race you are, your economic status, whether you're single or you have family support. I have some personal and painful experience with this recently. I lost my father, some of you know, over the holidays after years and years of declining physical health and dementia. He was determined to live out his days with dignity. He also happened to be a retired public official with a good pension and a support circle of family and friends. But even with all of those advantages, it was a daily challenge for him to meet his needs so he can live in place and maintain a good quality of life. Millions of Californians share a similar story, and the numbers are going to only grow. It's time for a new master plan on aging in California. We deferred for too long. Way too long. And in it, you know, it's got to address person-centered care, the patchwork of public services. It's got to address social isolation, bedlocked seniors that need transportation, address the nursing shortage with LVNs and RNs, and the demand on IHSS, our in-home support services, that far outpaces its capacity. And you know, we can't talk about aging without also focusing on Alzheimer's. Too many of us have seen the crushing grip of this disease on our loved ones, especially on our wives and mothers. Because two-thirds of all new Alzheimer's cases are women. Two-thirds. So today I'm launching the Alzheimer's Prevention and Preparedness Task Force, bringing the most renowned scientists and thinkers together to develop the first of its kind research in this era. And it will be headed by a leading advocate for families dealing with Alzheimer's. And that is our former First Lady, Maria Shriver, who is here today. And we are grateful for her continued service. Thank you, Maria. Tying together many of these hard challenges we face is the broader cost crisis. You know, in a recent survey came out last week, 61% of young adults in California said they can't afford to live here. 61%. California should never be a place where only the well-off can lead a good life. And it starts with housing, perhaps the most overwhelming challenge we face right now. We all know the problem. Too much demand, too little supply. And that is happening in large part because too many cities and counties aren't even planning how to build. Some are flat out refusing to do anything at all. That's why I committed $750 million for a major new incentive package for communities to do the right thing. $250 million in support for cities and counties to update their housing plans, to revamp their zoning process, and get more housing entitled. 500 more in grants when they achieve certain milestones. Look, if we want a California for all, we have to build housing for all. I appreciate that. We cannot defer this any longer. I want to support local government. I want to support local governments to do what's right, like Anaheim, like Santa Rosa. But there's got to be accountability for those that do not. You know, 2 weeks ago, the state of California sued the city of Huntington Beach for failing to meet its obligations on affordable housing. And let me just tell you, look, as a former mayor, the last thing I want to do is to start my term suing a city. But respectfully, they left us no choice. And by the way, it's not about picking on Huntington Beach. They just happened to be first because of a statute of limitations. But there are 47 other cities across California that are not complying with their planning requirements in one way or another. Some cities are trying, like Clovis. But others, respectfully, like Wheatland, Huntington Park, Montebello, they're not. And so I'm inviting all these city leaders to sit down with me in Southern California next week for a candid conversation. I do not intend to file suit against all 47, but I'm not going to preside over neglect and denial any longer. The crisis, folks. We all need to step up. Every part of this state. Every part of this state. I was a local elected official. I'm not naive here, folks. Cities need to summon that political courage, and we got to have their backs. Look, I also want to acknowledge that there are other factors beyond city planning that have limited our ability to provide more housing. In recent years, you know, we've done a good job expediting judicial review on CEQA for professional sports. But it's time to do the same thing for housing. There's some good things happening in this space. I want to applaud the recent efforts by home builders and labor leaders who together are working to forge a compromise in this space to accelerate production. But there's no way we can achieve our ambitious targets unless we train a skilled workforce that's big enough to meet the challenge and also make sure that we have workers that are getting wages that are high enough to also support their families. Well, let's encourage this process. Let's encourage this process. Let's encourage this process, and let's bring more people to the table to get something big done. I am confident we can do that this year. And while we're at it, let's not forget about something else. A lot of us made commitments, myself included, after Proposition 10 failed at the ballot last November. And the pressure on vulnerable renters did not go away after election. We need new rules to stabilize neighborhoods, to prevent evictions without putting small landlords out of business. So I want the best idea from everyone in this chamber. And here's my promise to you. Get me a good package on rent stability this year, and I will sign it. We can do that as well, folks. Mr. Bloom. All right, if we're serious about taming the cost crisis, we also need to be serious about making sure healthcare is affordable for all Californians. And our ability to invest in everything we care about is constrained by this issue, by the growing pressure of rising healthcare costs. It impacts everything we do. And with respect, the White House is laser focused, has been for years, on destroying the Affordable Care Act. Their vandalism, by the way, has already done extraordinary damage in California by eliminating the individual mandate. This year, covered California's premiums increased almost twice as much as we had expected. This is exactly what we feared, and respectfully, it's exactly what they wanted. And that's why, when it comes to the individual mandate, California must act where Washington has failed. And if we do this, we're going to be able to deepen subsidies for those earning up to $48,000 and extend subsidies to families earning up to $150,000, something no other state in America has done. We have the ability to do that. On another issue, we all know that California has among the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rates in America. And that's why in our budget, we devote more than $1 billion to increase rates and address the growing provider shortage. This investment will allow us to increase access to preventative health measures like immunizations, trauma screenings, and mental health services, as well as provide $100 million for reproductive health and family planning in our state. while we pursue the long-term goal of single-payer financing, let us make a down payment now by expanding Medi-Cal coverage for Californians up to the age of 26, regardless of their immigration status. Let's do that this year. But access is only part of the solution. Cost is another. We must address rising costs throughout the system, like the consolidation of hospitals and other health providers, which in many cases have limited patient choice and they've made medical care simply more expensive. We also must continue to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. Look, my first act as governor was to lay the foundation for a single purchasing system, the largest state buyer in the nation, which, by the way, will save hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the people of California. And I want to thank, at least someone cares about that savings, but I want to thank President Trump. I want to thank President Trump for calling attention to prescription drug prices last week in his State of the Union. This is a bipartisan issue. At least it should be, and I hope he follows through and takes the lead of California in the process. Let's talk about jobs. You know, we got to ask ourselves, how do we create a future with more good jobs and higher wages? Because when it comes to making life in California more affordable, cost is only one side of the equation. The other is income. So despite our rising wages, working families in California today barely earn more than they did a decade ago. Many working parents are making less than their parents did at the same age. That's why with your support, we will be providing this year a cost of living refund by expanding the earned income tax credit to 1 million more Californians. 1 million. By the way, if you approve the budget for families with kids under the age of 6, they will see their benefits go up by as much as 3 times. Look, in this economy, which ain't bad. Look, in this economy where the world of work is in a perpetual state of flux, where workers are too often displaced, devalued, and disconnected from the social safety net, we also must think bigger. It's time to develop a new modern compact for California's changing workforce. This, respectfully, is much bigger than Dynamex. California needs a comprehensive statewide strategy to uplift and upskill our workers to ensure that technological advancements in AI and blockchain and big data are creating jobs, not destroying jobs. And I believe we need to reform our institutions so that more workers have an ownership stake in their sweat equity. So we're going to appoint a new commission on California's workforce and future of work that will bring together leaders from labor, business, both public and private. And their assignment is this: to come up with new ideas to expand worker opportunity without extinguishing innovation or flexibility. Because California is obviously proud to be home of technology companies that are determined to change the world. But companies that make, respectfully, billions of dollars collecting, curating, monetizing our personal data also have a duty to protect it. Consumers have the right to know and control how their data is being used. And so I want to applaud you, this legislature, for passing the first in the nation digital privacy law last year. Thank you, Mr. Hochberg. But, California consumers should also be able to share in the wealth that is created from their data. So I've asked my team to develop a proposal for a new data dividend for Californians. because we recognize the data has value and it belongs to you. We can do something bold in this space. Let me end by making the obvious point. We've covered a lot of ground, but there's a lot more that deserves our focus. Climate change, reforming our tax code, our criminal justice system, major initiatives like paid sick leave, universal preschool, free community college, reimagining the DMV. On the list. There's so much more. And we'll be taking on all those issues and more in the coming months. Look, at my inaugural, a few weeks back, I quoted the Sermon on the Mount about a house that did not fall in the face of floods and storms because it was founded upon a rock. I promise that together we will build one house for one California. We've started drawing the blueprint for that house, and together we're going to finish it. But this goes deeper than budget numbers or even program details. This is about the bonds between us as human beings. You know, as St. Paul said, we are many parts but one body. We're all diminished when one of us struggles to lead a good life. The problems we face are as hard as they come, and they're in many cases decades in the making. But I truly believe we have the tools to solve them. We have the technology, we have the know-how, but most importantly, we have the generosity of our people. I don't know how many of you remember the story of that registered nurse up in Paradise who was sitting in traffic trying to escape the fire as flames started to engulf his car. He thought, this is it. And he recorded a goodbye video to his family. And then a miracle occurred. A bulldozer came out of nowhere and cleared the burning cars out of his path. At that point, he could have just driven away as fast as possible. That's what a lot of us would have done. But instead, he turned his car around and he drove straight to the hospital in the middle of the town where he worked in the ICU. He and his colleagues started treating injured people, and then the hospital caught on fire. And he moved patients to the helipad that was 100 yards away as fast as he could. Every single one of them was safely evacuated. And when he was asked why he did this, why he drove back through the fire when he could have just saved himself, he shrugged and he said, this is what we do. His name is Alan Pierce, and he's here with us today. Alan's right. Taking care of each other, showing courage when it matters most, this is what we do in California. Yes, we have much left to do, but I believe in the remarkable talent assembled here, and I believe in our state, and I know this at the bottom of my heart, the best is yet to come. Thank you all very, very much.